Josh Bell hates everything.
That's right, including your movie.
Josh Bell hates everything.
Except me.
Hello and welcome to the Josh Bell Hates Everything podcast. I'm Josh Bell, contributing editor and film critic for Las Vegas Weekly. And joining me this week is Tony Macklin, film historian, author of the book Voices from the Set, and a former professor of film and a all-around expert.
And I have a website.
That's true, TonyMacklin.net.
Thank you. I'm a hateful critic as well.
Yes,
so
we both hate everything.
Let us go.
But this week will actually be about things that we like, because this is our year-end wrap-up edition. So we're going to be counting down our 10 favorite movies of the year, and we'll get started. Starting with Tony, what's your number 10 movie?
I have a real problem with my number 10 movie. It's a critic's quandary when he likes a lot a film almost everybody else denigrates.
Right,
dismisses.
I've had this problem before, yeah.
And in fact, you, writing to me at one time, said you detested this movie.
Well, oh, right.
My movie is 7 pounds.
Oh, my God. Let me speak.
Go ahead. Then you can, the bile and the hate can come forth. It just worked for me. I think it's a film you probably either love or hate. And I had to come up with my best 10 before I really found out what the critics' reaction was and what the audience's reaction was. And
right.
The critics on Rotten Tomatoes, it's 26%. So at least there are a quarter of the who at least have some feeling for the film.
Right, right.
I think what is so important to me are two things. That a film does what it says it sets out to do, and secondly, that it is human. It's about the human condition and human experience, and it strikes my chord of humanity. I loved Rosario Dawson, and in fact, even the people who haven't liked the film.
I liked her too, yeah.
Liked her a lot.
She's always good. She's always good.
It's a film that you must not know the ending to. The first half of it is obtuse, kind of complex, going all over the place. But to me, bottom line, it works. I feel like I'm Clarence Darrow in Dayton, Tennessee, or wherever he was, defending a winning cause, maybe, in a losing environment. But I put 7 pounds.
Oh, God. You know, we were talking about this last week on the show, and I kept saying how I wished I could spoil the ending for people because it's so awful and so unbelievable and illogical and not human at all. To me, this movie made no sense, like, from an emotional standpoint either.
Well, a film is so dependent on the viewer's humanity, and if the viewer lacks humanity.
Okay, all right, yeah, that's a cheap shot there. No, you know what? I would put this movie on my list of the worst movies of the year. That is how much I disliked. I don't think we're going to have such a sharp disagreement on anything else.
I think this shows the validity. I assume that both of our opinions are intelligent. There's evidence.
Well, I might question you after this.
We just have a different point of view. And when you want to find reviews, you don't look at Pete Hammond's the television, who
true.
Loves everything.
Right.
You find a critic who has the same values. And even if you disagree with him on occasion, you know that basically he's coming from where you're coming. And so
right. Clearly you're not coming from where I'm coming. Okay.
Let's end. I would like to end with an affirmative statement without a callow reaction to my 10th film.
Seven pounds. I respect your opinion.
Thank
I respect
you.
Your opinion. My number 10 film is a documentary by the great Errol Morris, Standard Operating Procedure, which is one of the many, many documentaries that have been made about the situation in Iraq. This is specifically about Abu Ghraib. And I think going into this movie, I thought, I really don't need to see another one of these movies. I've seen plenty of them, and I'm fatigued, I'm worn out on it, and I had read a lot of good things about this movie, but I thought, it's not gonna work for me. But it's really good, and I think one of the main reasons this movie is so good is that it's not just a sort of talking head journalistic account of what went on. Morris interviews, he gets great interviews. He interviews most of the guards, the people who worked at Abu Ghraib, who were involved in the in what went on there. And he doesn't, you know, you could criticize him because he doesn't pull back and give you a big picture look. He isn't interviewing politicians. He isn't interviewing intellectuals or activists or anything like that. But he really gives you a good sense of how these people could do the things that they did without necessarily understanding the consequences. And it's a really interesting examination, too, of because it, the whole situation was blown up based on these photographs that came out. And it's this really interesting examination, I think, of what you don't see in photographs. And he shows how certain ones were cropped when they were released to the media and things like that. And it's a movie that made me feel sympathetic to these people who had done these things that are really awful, but people like Lindy England. And so I think that was a fascinating thing about it. And also the fact that it's really artfully made, you know.
So it also basically meets my barometer for humanity, right?
Yeah, I would think so. And I don't know, did you see
this?
Yes,
I did. I concur in your affirmation.
Thank you. I appreciate that. that's the only documentary on my list, but I think it's well worth seeing, even if you're fatigued with all the stuff about the Iraq War. I think it's worthwhile. So you want to take it ahead for number 9? Or
sure. Number 9, fine. W.
I like W.
And Oliver Stone seemed unlikely because he seemed probably very political, and maybe he would caricature a person who was already a caricature actual life. Josh Brolin is terrific. By the way, I liked Oliver Stone's treatment with Anthony Hopkins of Nixon. I thought that was he based it in a sense on Citizen Kane. And there's a little bit of Citizen Kane in this movie. But Josh Brolin's performance, I think, was very fine. And Richard Dreyfuss as the VP, Cheney, was spot on.
Yeah.
And this film was amusing.
It was.
It was one you chuckled at, and despite yourself, it became an entertaining experience.
Right. I think it's another movie that makes you sympathetic to someone that you did not think you might be sympathetic towards.
Well, when I would have voted for him when he was in Texas. I would have voted for him when he lost the first election and learned the political nastiness by being the victim of that.
Right, right. Yeah, I like this movie too, and I think it got sort of mixed reviews, but I think it deserved a little better, and I would have loved to see Josh Brolin get more attention, you know, from awards groups or whatever, which he hasn't really, and I don't think he's going to get an Oscar nomination, but he did a very good job.
But he's gotten very good reviews, probably more than he deserves for his performance in Milk.
I agree. I mean, I like him as an actor, and that was a fine, decent enough performance, but I don't see it as an awards-worthy one.
I thought not anybody, but any gifted actor could have done just as good a job.
Yeah, they don't. One of the deficiencies of Milk, I think, not that this is a movie I assume is on our list, but one of the deficiencies of that movie is that they don't give you a lot about that character, the Josh Brolin
character.
Will
you stop speaking for me and please
speak
for
yours?
No, and don't apologize. I can't stand apologies.
Tony Macklin may have Milk on his list. We will find out in a little bit.
Stay tuned.
Stay tuned, exactly. So my number 9 movie is a very small indie film that didn't ever play in Las Vegas this year, but it was one I caught up with on DVD that I think is really worth seeking out. It's called Chop Shop from this director, Ramin Barani. And this is, I think, the second film that he's made, and I haven't seen his first, is a movie called Man Push Cart. And both are about sort of marginalized immigrants in New York City. Man Push Cart was about an Arab immigrant, I believe, who runs a food stand. And Chop Shop is about a young Hispanic kid, like 12 years old, I think, who's basically like a street urchin and tries to hustle his way into making a bit of money. He works in the shadow of Shea Stadium in these junkyards, which are sort of semi-legal car shops where some people take their cars to get fixed and some of them are stolen cars that get chopped up. And he has this dream of he and his 16-year-old sister are going to open up a truck, like one of those taco trucks that drives by construction sites and things like that. And it's a movie about extreme poverty, the kind of poverty that you would expect to see in a movie like City of God or something that you almost don't really realize exists in America. And yet it's about this character who's extremely optimistic and about his plans for his life and the way that he thinks that things are going to work out. And I think it's a very you know, despite the squalor that the people, the characters live in, it's a very positive movie. And I really liked, it's a very naturalistic depiction of this stuff. It doesn't have a whole lot of plot, but, and it has an excellent performance by the lead kid. And I hate kid actors a lot of the
time. Did you like it better than Slumlord?
Oh, Slumdog Millionaire?
Yeah.
I did, because I think Slumdog Millionaire, although it's a good movie, I liked it, and this is another one we talked about last week, the realism of Slumdog Millionaire and the poverty that they depict in that is sort of clashes with the fairy tale-ish story of the guy finding his true love and winning on a video a game show and things like that. And I think this movie is a lot more down-to-earth. There's a lot more, you could imagine almost that it's a documentary, you know? You could imagine these people really existing and these things really happening. So that's one that got a very limited release, but it is available on DVD. I hope people will check it out. And
okay.
You want to go ahead?
Eighth. The first, can you judge with great affirmation the first half of a movie and say the second half of it does not make it?
Right.
I loved the first half of The Dark Knight, the Batman movie.
Right.
Then it became caricature. The director, Nolan, right?
Right, Christopher Nolan, yeah.
Fell in love with special effects. Two-Face took over and split the movie. So The Dark Knight is number 8 on my list, basically for the first half, which I think was wonderful action-adventure filmmaking.
Yeah. I think I've talked about The Dark Knight a number of times on here and also on the radio, and I have mixed feelings about The Dark Knight. I didn't put that on my list, and I don't think it's one of the best movies of the year, but I like a lot of what it does.
How about, I know it's been over-talked about, but Heath Ledger's performance.
I thought Heath Ledger gave a perfectly good performance for what that role called for.
He actually trumped, and this is unheard of, he trumped Jack Nicholson.
See, I disagree. I love that movie with Nicholson so much. That's one of my favorite movies, period, of any year. And I don't think it quite, but I he did a very good job. I don't think he necessarily deserves an awards nomination because it's a one-note performance, and that's not a criticism, I don't think, of his acting ability. It's just that's what the character is. It's a sort of one-note character, and he plays that one note very well.
No, I would say there's a dimension to his performance, that it's not one note. In fact, Jack Nicholson is like one note.
Well, right, and again, but not in
but
a bad way, I don't
I
think.
I don't think Heath Ledger is one note. I think there's a humanity, there's more horror, sadness, energy, passion, those things that make the human condition come alive in Heath Ledger's performance.
Really? I mean, I found that to be, the character is very inhuman, which is part of the point of the character, I think. So, I don't know. I mean, I'm not against seeing him rewarded posthumously for that performance because I think it's a good performance. And I always liked stuff that Heath Ledger did, but I think the movie as a whole is overrated, and I think he's been a little overrated as well.
Heath Ledger is a human who becomes inhuman humanly, okay?
That's fair enough. I don't know if I can quite get all the way. He's a human who becomes inhuman, but I don't know. Yeah, so The Dark Knight, I think, I'm completely on board, but that's a fair. And here, I was just thinking, were we going to disagree strongly again? And I think we will, because of my number 8 movie is a movie that I know you extremely disliked, which is Cloverfield.
I don't extremely dislike it at all.
I thought
we had a disagreement about how good it is.
Okay.
I thought, given the fact that it's handheld and the characters are very, very superficial, but I think for what it is, it is an entertainment that I wouldn't disparage, but I would never put it on my top 100. I mean, my top 10.
all right. So, you know, this is a movie I think that when I saw it, I probably had the same opinion that you did, that I thought it was a fun entertainment, and that was about it. But thinking more on it, especially, I think, in comparison to other kinds of special effects movies or big, you know, Hollywood extravaganzas, I think it's actually has a lot more depth to it. Even though the characters themselves, you're correct, are superficial, I think by necessity, because it's not the kind of movie where it affords the opportunity for us to get backstory. I mean, because it only depicts what happens from the moment they turn on the camera till the moment they turn off the camera.
Key question. Have you seen it again?
I haven't seen any of these movies again. So I almost never see movies
again. It's grown in your mind.
Well, but that's something that happens, I think, with a lot of movies where you reflect on it more, or you might read what someone else has written about it, and you make certain connections. So, no, I mean, I rarely see movies again. Yeah, I haven't seen any of these movies more than once.
You make a really almost profound point.
Oh,
that,
okay.
No, that a film does. In 10 years, for instance, we may view Benjamin Button, which I think both of us were not enthusiastic. I was not enthusiastic.
Yeah, right.
In 10 years, it may be different. I know that when I saw Dirty Harry, it didn't work for me as much as it did 10 or 20 years later. That films, especially if they have dimension, especially if they have quality, in the mind, they do bloom.
Right. I think so. And I don't think you have to necessarily go see the movie again to modify your opinion or augment your opinion, although, you know, maybe it would help. But I think it's an interesting sort of meta commentary on those other kinds of more traditional special effects blockbusters about, like, what happens to the characters that we don't see, the people who don't save the day, or, you know, who aren't instrumental in defeating the threat, and what about the people that just get squashed, the extras from Independence Day? And I liked that about it, and I liked the way that it sort of did think about how do we deal with unimaginable disaster. I mean, obviously monsters aren't attacking our cities, but horrible things do happen, and maybe the 9/11 connection was overstated, but events like that, whether it's a natural disaster or a terrorist attack or whatever, do occur, and I thought it had an honest portrayal of how
that disorientation.
The disorientation, not knowing what's going on, and simply wanting everyone you know to be okay. I think that was interesting. So I liked it, and I think it came out all the way back in January, but it's worth remembering, I think.
So. My seventh film?
Yes, go right ahead.
2008's version of The Wizard of Oz. Milk.
Oh, okay. All right.
Sean Penn and Gus Van Sant combined to make this warm tribute to Harvey Milk. Now, again, it's got some actuality, but if you want the complete actuality, see the documentary that was made about it. I thought it was Harvey Milk was the first openly gay man that was ever elected publicly to public office, the Board of Supervisors in San Francisco. And a lot of this, you have to suspend your disbelief at some point when in a movie, when you're watching a movie. I thought that I may not share Van Sant's and Penn's, thank God for me, Sean Penn, for maybe the first time in his life, didn't overact.
Right, and he smiles, and yes. Harvey Milk is a happy guy.
Yes.
It was very nice.
Well, I think that's what he was.
Right.
He was a very openly gregarious kind of individual.
Yeah.
I can see how people would completely dismiss this. For me, bottom line, it delivered on what it set out to be, and I thought what it set out to be was worth considering.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, I liked Sean Penn's performance in the movie, but I felt like it was so biopic conventional that it didn't grab me enough. It didn't make me want to learn more about Harvey. Franco was good, but I feel like all of the supporting performances were at that same sort
And Alison Pill was good.
They were all good. I mean, I would say for across the board, Emile Hirsch and even Josh Brolin that we were talking about earlier, they all did perfectly good work. But none of them I felt like were outstanding, and it wasn't because they didn't act well enough. It was simply because all of those parts are very underwritten. They're all very much like stock. I mean, and they're real people, but they serve sort of stock purposes in the biopic
story. How about the
story.
Style of the film? The visuals?
There wasn't much of a visual style to it. I mean, especially compared to the things that Gus Van Sant has done in recent years just before this, which are not necessarily great movies, things like Last Days and Elephant, the very like the long takes with not a lot of dialogue and things like that, which can be grating, I think, but at least you can look at those movies, the last like four movies he did, and say, this guy has a real style that he's developed here. Whereas he kind of throws that out the window, I think, in this movie and just does it.
I liked the lighting a lot.
Yeah?
I thought the lighting was almost a character in this movie.
Hmm. You know, I don't think I noticed a whole lot of lighting in this movie. But no, I mean it's not a movie I would say don't see. I just think it was, you know, average. It was functional, would be my take on it. So my number seven pick is The Whackness, which was a movie I saw back at the Cinevegas Film Festival over the summer that had a sort of limited release. And, you know, actually this probably makes all my criticisms of Milk seem kind of hypocritical, because the reason I like The Whackness is it is actually quite a conventional story. It's not a biopic, but it's a very conventional coming-of-age kind of story. It doesn't really do a whole lot that you haven't seen in other coming-of-age movies. But I thought it was very, the portrayal of teenage life felt very real to me and very natural, even though the lead character speaks in this very unnatural sort of way of talking. But I think part of that is about how as a teenager you sort of adopt these affectations in order to figure out your own identity or emulate people that you think are cool or are above you. And Josh Peck, who plays the main character, I think does a good job of being this sort of sympathetic but rather dopey teenager. And he falls in love with Olivia Thirlby, who I think is great and is always good as the sort of ridiculously idealistic love interest. She played basically the same part in Snow Angels. But the love story doesn't work out the sort of happy, conventional way that you would expect it to. And Ben Kingsley does a really good job hamming it up as but in a good way, because it's a funny, comedic part as the psychiatrist who is also one of the main character's clients. He's a drug dealer. And it was just a movie that I thought was very entertaining. I smiled throughout. I identified with things that the character went through. And I thought it was a good example of a genre that has certainly been done many times.
I'll have a Ben Kingsley film later.
Okay. All right. I think, and Ben Kingsley is interesting because he was in a few of the movies this year, and he can be deathly over the top in a very bad way, but I think he was over the top in a good way in this movie.
Well, I think when he's over the top, he knows he's over the top. It's not, and he's decided to do it for the characterization.
Yeah, but
he can't go through his whole life playing Gandhi.
No, but I think he's almost like swung so far in the other direction that it's become a little absurd. But it worked in The Whackness, I think. So,
Six? Now, I have to say that I have a thing for Clint Eastwood. You have to understand. I taught a college course on Clint Eastwood at the time when the alumni were writing letters. What has become of the University of Dayton where we're teaching this instead of
Citizen Kane or Milton?
Milton and Shakespeare and Byron and whatever. I thought the thing about Clint at this point is that he shouldn't be directing at 78. He shouldn't
Why
be
not?
Doing anything.
Why not?
Well, because if you study the history of film, Hawks didn't make films for the last 7 years of his life or died.
So you're saying that Ford Clint didn't, is in the last seven years of his life, giving him a death wish?
He's 78.
He could live another 20 years.
Okay. All right.
His mother is still alive.
No, she isn't.
Oh, did she just die? Oh, okay. She was like 2 years ago,
yes.
though.
Yes. I mean, no, I'll talk about him again later, but The Changeling is my number six. It was based on an actual case in 1928, and I think color, texture, impact of this film. I'm willing to be maybe extremely tolerant of Clint, but for me, he does give me something in return. And like Eastwood himself, Angelina Jolie, the actress who plays this character, will not settle, and she goes on a harrowing mission to seek the truth. And I found it intriguing in its own way.
Yeah. Did you really compare Angelina Jolie to Clint Eastwood?
Yes, I did. Yeah.
All right. Well, maybe she'll too live to 78.
I compared her character to
her
Clint
the
Eastwood.
The dogged, dedicated.
Yes.
I was kind of lukewarm on this one as well. A lot of these movies, I didn't think it was a bad movie. And I like, you know, I'm I don't see how you could not respect Clint Eastwood for churning out this many movies.
We don't use churning out.
Oh, okay.
No, that's a negative term.
But I mean, the guy works like crazy at his age and does well. I mean, even I didn't think this was a great movie, but it was certainly like well put together.
This brings up a point, Josh, that there's an idea that people and critics are objective. Of course we aren't. To be objective is to be almost
inhuman?
not knowing.
Right.
Yeah. You go to a film with expectations, hopes.
Right.
You go into a film rooting for the film.
Sure.
And it may disappoint you. In fact, later I'll talk about going to a film with great, great, great trepidation. And when a film does give you what you're looking for, you are pleased.
Right, yeah. I mean, there's an emotional response, certainly.
And then you go to a film where you have great David Fincher has to give us...
Right, and you
he
feel
can't,
let down.
David Fincher plotting in Benjamin Button? How can this man make a film? We agreed on Zodiac.
Zodiac was
that
great,
we loved Zodiac. But how can David Fincher plod? So I go with expectations,
right.
And for me... They weren't
right. Well, I will get to that because I liked that movie a lot. But yeah, that's totally true. I mean, you can try, and sometimes you can go into something without expectation if you don't know anything about it. But for the most part, that's absolutely true. And you know, so I won't begrudge you your love of Clint Eastwood or you're willing to give him the benefit of the doubt. And I'm certainly not. You know, I thought last year he directed two movies last year as well, and Letters from Iwo Jima last year I thought was very well done. And these movies he's done this year, I think, don't really live up to that. They're sort of minor. And I think a lot of it is in the writing, that he's a very, like, barrel-ahead kind of director. And if he's got a good script, then he'll direct the hell out of it. But if the writing is limp, then he's not going to elevate it to something beyond what it is.
That's a good point. I want to make clear that I'm not giving him a pass.
Right.
That if I didn't feel that he had fulfilled his quote obligations, I'd go to the films saying, well, this is the time I'm going
to finally let you
put
down.
Him back,
right.
Put him in his place, and it didn't happen.
Yeah. All right. That's fair. My number six movie is one of the most successful movies box office wise of the year, which is, I think, a movie that you didn't like, which is the Pixar movie WALL-E. Which is, I thought was just, I mean, first of all, a great entertainment. Like the last few that I've talked about are just, it's just a joy to watch, I think. I had a lot of fun watching it. And it is another one of those movies I think the first half is better than the second half.
Well, obviously, you identified with WALL-E more
than
I did.
Well, that's true. I'm quite robotic, so that is a good point, and lonely. But this movie, the first, I don't know, half hour, 40 minutes or so, which are basically dialogue-free and just involve WALL-E and the other robot Eve that he falls in love with, and it's almost silent movie.
Oh, is that clever? Eve, huh?
Right. Well, it's not a movie that's full of a lot of subtlety, I don't think. I mean, it's a movie that kids can certainly appreciate. I mean, I don't think it's necessarily made solely for kids, but it's a movie that is simple enough, but not simplistic, that kids can enjoy it. But there's no reason I don't think that doesn't mean that others couldn't enjoy it as well. And I think the craftsmanship in this movie is just astonishingly accomplished.
Well, I loved Ratatouille.
Yeah.
And to me, Ratatouille's a great film, and this is not.
And I think I felt the exact opposite. Yeah. Like, I think this is a great movie, and Ratatouille, although I liked Ratatouille, was disappointing, especially because the director of Ratatouille, Brad Bird, had made a couple of really great movies, I think. But honestly, I would say at this point I prefer Andrew Stanton, who directed WALL-E and also directed Finding Nemo, which is probably my favorite Pixar movie. Both really good, really, I think, emotionally affecting, where you can identify with, you know, the little robot, or you'd identify with the fish.
Finding Nemo certainly had more color.
Yeah. I mean, this is a movie that maybe it requires a little more work to get into, but I think it's sort of basic comedy, almost physical comedy.
Well, he's been compared to Charlie Chaplin, right?
And maybe, you know, that's a little highfalutin, but it's close, maybe.
Charlie Chaplin would not like to be considered highfalutin. Tramp was certainly not highfalutin.
Maybe that's the wrong word, but I mean, Charlie Chaplin is sort of the gold standard for this kind of thing, and maybe it doesn't quite reach that. But I think it's in a similar league. And again, the second half, when there's the human characters introduced and there's a somewhat heavy-handed message about the environment and stuff like that, was not as strong. But I think as a whole, it's very entertaining. It's incredibly well put together. And, you know, heartwarming. And it takes a lot to warm my heart, my cold, cold heart. So I liked it.
Point taken.
All right.
Fifth, I also have a thing for Sir Alfred Hitchcock.
Okay, yeah, I'm with you
and
on that.
And every year I hope there will be some film that will at least have Hitchcockian overtones.
Right.
And here's a film that I don't think many people have seen that I really can recommend, Trans-Siberian.
Oh, I liked that. I'm with you on that. I liked it a lot.
And it was directed by Brad Anderson, and it's mostly set on a train that treks across the frozen tundra from China and Mongolia to Moscow.
Right.
And it involves intrigue, murder, drugs, and Kingsley
was in this film. Performance.
Yeah, well, but no, not ridiculous.
His Russian
come up
accent.
Come up with another term.
I like this movie a lot, but I mean, Kingsley is sort of absurd.
I think the menace, he is menacing. There is menace to the character. And there is, it's an intriguing, suspenseful movie.
Yeah, I agree.
I recommend, for those listeners who are looking for a film that they might not have heard of or they might have missed, I suggest seeing Trans-Siberian.
I absolutely agree. It would have been, you know, right outside my top 10, I think. I liked it a lot. And I think it is available on DVD now, so it's definitely worth checking out. My number five is one movie that I know we both liked a lot, which is the Woody Allen film, Vicky Cristina Barcelona. And Woody Allen, I think I may feel about Woody Allen as you do about Clint Eastwood, that every movie I go in sort of hoping, and I want to give him the benefit of the doubt, but maybe unlike you and Clint, he disappoints probably as often as not, at least lately in the last, you know, well, really probably in almost my lifetime, you know, although I love his older movies that I've caught up with. But I think,
what are your favorites?
Manhattan, I love. I mean, of course, Annie Hall, Hen and Her Sisters. I love.
They're all very humanistic.
Oh, yeah,
Those films are extremely humanistic.
Absolutely, absolutely. And I tend to like the sort of, I don't like the broad comedies as much. I mean, you know, the early stuff. But I love Radio Days.
How about Play It Again, Sam?
I haven't seen Play It Again, Sam. Which he didn't direct, right? He only wrote.
No, but and he's in it.
Yeah,
I mean,
yeah.
But it's good.
No, there's so many.
Very entertaining.
There's definitely a number that I've missed. But no, I love Woody Allen. And I've seen, there's a few early ones that I still haven't seen. But of course, I've seen everything he's done in the last, 10, 15 years, a lot of which is really crappy. But this movie is not crappy. Let's focus on the positive. It's a really, it's sort of between the comedy and the drama, which I think is what I like best about Allen. Some of his really, really heavy dramas, something like, what am I thinking of? September, I think.
Interiors,
that's what I'm thinking of. It's just too much for me. Too Bergman for me. But this movie, I think you can take the characters seriously. Rebecca Hall does a really good job, I think, as the lead. And Scarlett Johansson, who can often be really rough, I think, in roles that don't play to her strengths, I think does probably her best work in a Woody Allen movie here as the character who sort of hops into bed with Javier Bardem, who is always good. And Penelope Cruz is great in her supporting performances as a sort of crazy ex-girlfriend.
In fact, she may win the Oscar for Best Supporting Actress.
Yeah, I think there's a very good chance, and I would be happy to see that happen. And it's just, it's very cynical about love, which of course Woody Allen always is, but it's the kind of movie I think you can watch, and even though at the end you realize this movie is all about how these people could not get what they want, and they all end up disappointed, and yet you feel good afterwards. And I like that. It's, you know, the scenery is nice in Barcelona. I think going to Europe has worked for him, and it was just a very, very well-made, well-written movie.
I agree completely. Complete agreement.
Yeah, all right.
Now, fourth, I shouldn't talk about Clint's age, since you since you said that.
But
I went to this
issue.
Movie knowing that this was going to be, my number four is Gran Torino.
Right.
knowing this was going to be his last appearance on screen.
Well, although he's kind of backtracked on that at this point.
He has and he hasn't. He's all, throughout his career, he said he won't make another Dirty Harry. He will not bring Harry Callahan back.
Right.
But this is close to bringing him back.
It is. It really is.
And there are two things that I would ask the audience. I think it's going to go wide
January
19th
to
look at. One, how many times Clint's character, Walt
I think, yeah.
Yeah, Walt, how many times he fires his gun.
Right.
And secondly, what is the last image of Clint?
Yeah.
And I think both are, if not tongue-in-cheek, but both are, he's very aware of his image. Now, that isn't enough to make a viable performance. I went hoping he wouldn't embarrass himself. And I think he's terrific.
Yeah.
As a gruff, ferociously antisocial individual, there are some soft moments, obviously, but I think he carries the film on his broad shoulders. And I think especially the people who have grown up with Clint will say, boy, Clint is still the man.
Well, he is. I mean, I think this movie is all about Clint being the man, you know? And it's funny, you mentioned it being partly tongue-in-cheek. Like, the whole time, and I've read a number of reviews of people who really like this movie who think the entire thing is a joke. I mean, like an intentional joke. It's a parody of these tough guy movies. I don't know if I really buy into that, and I don't know what your feeling is if you...
I think there are elements of it that are.
Yeah.
But I think the basic... I don't think Clint would ever... Because he's a humanist. He's a progressive.
Right, right.
And he cares about character.
Yeah.
And so that it has elements that are tongue-in-cheek and jokey, but the basis of it is the strength of his vision, and his vision is as it was when he began. It is a spiritual vision. It's strange to talk about Clint Eastwood being a spiritual creator, but he actually is. I mean, you can trace it all the way back through his films and see redemption is a theme in almost every one of them.
Yeah,
and there is, I don't want to get too academic, but the Christ figure certainly does appear in a lot of his films.
Yeah,
many times he isn't
movie,
the Christ
right.
figure. The Christ figure has to be sacrificed. Like the evil guy in where he played the Kennedy, the agent who had helped Kennedy.
Oh, in the line of fire?
In the line of fire.
Yeah.
The bad guy is the Christ figure, and the fact that he sacrificed redeems the other character.
Yeah.
But I think one thing about Clint, and I found this about Hitchcock too, Hitchcock, suspense, 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 and yet there's a whole level or levels of spirituality, satire, religion, family, beneath what he's known for. He's just known for one thing,
right.
As Clint is pretty much just known for one thing, as John Wayne was pretty much, but there's, the more that you get into their work and the more that they allow you to know them, the more elements you find there.
Yeah, I think that's a lot more than I found in this movie. I mean, not to say that that's not there in all Clint Eastwood movies or in some Clint Eastwood movies, but I just thought this movie was just poorly written. It was just, I mean, how many old-timey racial epithets, and that's a big thing about the character is a huge racist. And like,
well, not exact. I mean, he is. He never says the N-word.
Okay,
you know?
But he's,
that's
he
Clint.
Calls,
Clint.
He calls the black people spooks when he encounters the black thugs.
When he was gruff and antisocial, did you laugh or did you wince? Or did you do both?
I think I winced. And the problem is that, like I said, a lot of people who have been defending this movie say you're supposed to laugh. But I wasn't sure. I mean, I felt like if I had laughed, that's not the right reaction. Like, I didn't want to laugh. I didn't feel like it was a funny movie.
But I think you're coming from a different generation. I mean,
I think
this idea, I'm not saying you're politically correct, because I don't think you are, but this political correctness has really invaded everything to where the character can't say what he actually would say.
Well, I don't have a problem with the character saying those things. I just felt like it was so exaggerated and silly that, you know, it's not like the character has these ideas about other races and they explored it, or it annoys me that there's a character who has these opinions that I disagree with. It was the way that it was portrayed to me thought was so, it was such a caricature, not just of someone who is a racist, but also the sort of grumpy old man idea where he says, you know, he actually literally says, get off my lawn, or he literally says, what's with kids today?
He's a Korean War veteran.
Right.
I mean, he's not a modern man.
No. I understand that. And I think my problem wasn't with his character. It was the way his characteristics were expressed in the dialogue and in his action, and even in Clint's performance, which is very, like, scowly all the time, which seemed like a parody of the Clint Eastwood tough guy performance.
Could you ever laugh at racism?
Yeah, I absolutely think
okay.
so.
All
I absolutely
right.
think
okay.
so. Yeah, I think, like, Sarah Silverman, you know, that's her whole shtick. That's all she's got, is laughing at racism. And I think she's kind of played out, but I used to love Sarah Silverman. I think a lot of stuff she's done is very funny.
Very good.
I don't think that's the issue.
Okay.
Let's move on.
We're up to your four.
We're up to my number four. And as we briefly mentioned before, it's The Curious Case of Benjamin Button, which I liked a lot. I didn't like as much as Zodiac. I love David Fincher. But I think this movie works very well. I think the thing about Fincher is that he's made movies that are almost universally cold and distant and sort of meticulous and well-crafted, but not emotionally, you know, connecting. And that's not a criticism. I think he's excellent at that, and I like the way that he has this sort of, you know, jaundiced eye that he can take a look at subjects. And in this movie, it's a love story, and there's a lot of warmth to it, but I think it's still put together with that same sort of detached sense of craftsmanship, and that tension between those two things is what I found really interesting. That through the last, you know, hour of this movie, you know, it's gonna make you cry, or work to make you cry, but at the same time,
for different reasons, maybe.
Maybe for different reasons. But I think, you know, there's a lot of emotion to it with the romance, but at the same time, this is a movie about death. It's about, you know, it's constantly about how this character faces mortality everywhere he turns, and I thought you're shaking your head. You completely disagree.
Well, because I found it tiresome.
Yeah.
I didn't cry.
Right.
Let me ask you. I think self-indulgence is part of a great creator. Many
right.
of the films, Wild Bunch, is certainly self-indulgent.
Yeah. Yeah.
I love that film. Altman's films are self-indulgent.
Right.
I love
right.
Altman. Do you think this would have been a better film a little shorter?
A little shorter. I think the framing sequence, which has the Cate Blanchett character dying in the hospital during Hurricane Katrina, and Julie Ormond plays her daughter.
Where did Hurricane Katrina come?
Yeah, it's
from a Scott Fitzgerald story.
Right.
In Baltimore.
I don't think really almost anything comes from the Fitzgerald story.
It does not.
That you just kind of have to put that aside.
Particularly style.
Right, but at the same time, I do agree that that sequence was unnecessary, and it involves the daughter reading through Benjamin's diaries, which leads up to a revelation that's incredibly obvious. You can predict from the moment the movie begins, and I definitely would have liked it better had that been cut out. It would have been, you know, 20 minutes or whatever shorter, but I still thought everything else was so good that the movie really, really worked for me, and I'm still gonna, you know, stand behind everything that Fincher does. I think he's probably, you know, the best director working right now, or at least, you know, in my top five, you know. So I like
I know.
This movie a lot.
You said yes. You know three times.
Yes,
I know.
Yes.
I know, I know, I know.
You know. You do. Now you do.
Okay, number three. Frost Nixon, it's not a great film, but it's one that I think fulfills my does it work. It's like The Queen. It's entertaining. I could recommend this to almost anybody.
Yeah.
There are films that are for niches, for given audiences. I think there's enough drama and enough acting chops. I think the relationship between Langella, Nixon's Langella, and Michael Sheen's David Frost has some sparks, has some energy to it. It is a Ron Howard film, which it means it's not going to be very intellectual. It's going to be kind of Opie-esque.
Yeah.
But it fits well into my number three as an entertaining film that I could recommend to everybody.
Really? I wouldn't recommend this movie to, well, I wouldn't say not to anybody, but not,
Would your parents like it?
Yeah, you know, they might. I think if it's something like that you lived through the time, then it might be interesting simply to see how it's portrayed. Obviously, I didn't live through that time. But a lot of movies I like something like Milk, even that, which is another thing that I didn't live through. At the same time, I felt like it taught me a little bit, you know. Mm-hmm. This movie, I didn't feel like that necessarily. I thought this movie was a lot of dry, sort of schematic setup for a great 15 minutes or so when Frost and Nixon are really getting in. You know, when Frost finally hits Nixon with these serious questions that he actually has a tough time answering, and you get to sort of the meat of his angst over what happened, you know, in the last days of the last days he was in office, that I thought was really fascinating. Nixon interviews.
You don't rate nearly as highly as I do Langella's performance.
I don't. It seemed like an impression to me most of the time. It was distracting. And I know a lot of people really like his performance, but...
Oh, I think it's terrific.
It didn't grab me as a performance, as a person, rather than simply like doing the Nixon voice and the Nixon mannerisms and stuff, which he does well enough. So, it disappointed me. I don't even know if I would say it disappointed me, because I don't expect a whole lot from Ron Howard anymore, but... I wouldn't rate it as highly as you did. And a movie that I think you would not rate as highly as I did was my number three movie, which is Rachel Getting Married, which you liked even less than Cloverfield, which I thought was fabulous, is Jonathan Demme's film about a wedding with Anne Hathaway, who plays a drug addict who is sprung from rehab for 2 days to go to her sister's wedding. And this is a movie, I think, that if you simply describe the plot, or you had maybe even read the script, that it sounds like it could be a really cheesy sort of Lifetime TV movie of the week, the dark family secret, and the addict who can't deal with her father's lack of love, or things like that, that sound very cliched and very tiresome. And I think the way that Demme makes this movie, which is he shoots it in a very sort of naturalistic documentary style, and the performances I think are pretty understated but very strong. Anne Hathaway as well as Rosemary DeWitt, who plays Rachel, the one who's getting married, and Bill Irwin as the father. And I just thought it was really affecting in that it's not just about the terrible things that have happened. The fact that this one character is a drug addict, or the fact that they have this dark secret in the past of the family that comes out, that there's a lot of joy in it, and you really feel like you just spent time with this interesting, flawed, sort of screwed up, but endearing family. And that was the way I felt at the end. And you're about to tear this apart, aren't
no,
you?
No, I'm just going to say you've got to be a fan of women who whine. The writer here was Lumet.
Right, Jenny Lumet, yeah.
And she's the granddaughter of Lena Horne.
Right, the daughter of Lena Horne, isn't she?
No, and she's Sidney the granddaughter. Lumet? No, her
father is Sidney Lumet.
Yes, her father is Sidney Lumet, but Lena Horne's daughter married Sidney Lumet.
Okay. Gotcha.
And I love Demme usually with Silence of the Lambs or the film we saw in film club.
Melvin and Howard.
Howard. Yeah. I think it's an excellent director. This one just didn't work for me. I'm not a ritual person. I don't go to weddings. I don't go to funerals.
I hate actual weddings. I can't stand weddings.
And this cumbia, they dance and they sing and we all get together and never a curse or is heard. It just didn't work for me.
Right.
I don't disparage your enthusiasm for the film because a lot of people did have enthusiasm. I mean, my editor in Arkansas loved it. And I warned her, and she transcended my opinion. I'm just whining women, and that is a genre that has come up recently, the genre of weeping, whining, self-indulgent.
But I thought there was as much happiness in those characters as there was whining.
And then the big conflict about who loads the dishes into the dishwasher best.
Right, but
I felt like I was watching somebody's home movie.
Well, right, and I
wanted a drink desperately.
And I would say that I also felt like I was watching somebody's home movies, and that was what I liked about the movie, is that it depicted something that felt like a real window into people's lives, and that was what I liked about it.
Mediocre people, I don't want a window into their lives.
You don't
want
to meet them? No. All right. Go ahead with number two.
Number two, Woody Allen's triumphant return. Was number four on your list?
Yeah,
it's number two.
Movie.
So this is the film, I guess, we're
this is
supporting.
The one to see, right.
I debated on putting this one or two, and yeah. I finally put it two. He didn't act in it, but it was written and directed by the Woodman, and it's wonderfully acted. What you pointed out that it was about love and relationships that don't reach fruition.
Right.
I think it has the moment where a character decides what she's willing to risk for love.
Right.
And that maybe is a decision that every one of us will face in our life once or maybe more than once. I think I was one of the few that think it's based or it's relative to Jules and Jim's, to Francois Truffaut's film, Jules and Jim.
Yeah, no,
it has the same narrator, the same kind of music, the same humanity. To me, it can be listed among Woody's best films.
Yeah, I think maybe so. I do think so. I liked it a lot. I agree. Like I said, that's the one. If you take one thing away, I think that'll be go see that movie. Check that out. So my number two is, and I don't know if you've gotten to see this yet, was Mike Leigh's Happy Go Lucky, which is another female-centric film. Which a lot of people, I think this was maybe a love it or hate it film. I think a lot of people were really put off by the main character, Sally Hawkins, who I think does a great job as Poppy, the eternally happy school teacher in London in this movie. And she's constantly chipper. And I think at first the instinct is to be annoyed by a character like this who cannot be brought down and is basically upbeat about everything. And you sort of want to punch someone like that. And I think Lee does a really good job of playing with that expectation that when you see a movie like this that opens with someone who's really happy and thinks everything's great, that you expect something else is going to happen. This woman is going to get murdered, she's going to get cancer, and it's going to be about her learning something about the toughness of life.
Oh, would that had happened.
And I thought the best thing about this movie and the most daring thing about this movie was that didn't happen. That what happens in this woman's life is a lot of normal stuff that happens in everyone else's life. Some stuff is bad, some stuff is not bad, but ultimately she keeps that same perspective on life throughout, no matter what happens to her, and that because she has to encounter real people along the way who don't share that perspective, that it's about sort of the cost and the effort that goes into being happy and how that can be rewarding at the end.
Let me tell your audiences to be on an alert. Josh is looking for a woman who shrieks and giggles. Pollyanna is taken. Fran Drescher is taken.
Oh, no, those are awful comparisons.
And there was a third one, and I can't remember. Fran Drescher, Pollyanna,
for me.
And boy,
we'll come back.
Talk
it.
About I shouldn't be
should write these
shouldn't
things down.
Be as negative about your number two film. But
so you didn't like it.
I'm a gentleman, so I wouldn't leave a blind date with her. But I'd run as fast as I could,
I think there's a difference between wanting to know this person in reality. I think in reality, the person would probably annoy me. But I think as a movie that explores who this person is and how she lives her life, it was very interesting.
I just thought of the third one, Kathy Griffin.
You know what? I like Kathy.
I knew it. Okay, there it is. If you like Kathy Griffin, you will like Happy Go Lucky. Point made.
All right, fair enough. Go on. Tell us the best movie of the year.
Oh, my favorite movie. I could never say
your favorite
the
movie
best
of the year.
Movie,
right.
The one that worked best with me. And
right.
I was saying that I had a debate between this and Woody Allen's Vicky Cristina Barcelona. I thought this film was pitch perfect. And it it was about decency. It was an anthem of decency. Some people have thought it was too liberal. Some people have thought it was too manipulative. Neither of those were problems for me at all. I thought the leading actor gave as good a performance as was given this year. The actor is Richard Jenkins. The film is The Visitor.
Ah, yeah.
And The Visitor was, there's so little decency in modern life, and I thought that this was realistic decency and a character who grew, whose humanity was restored and amplified in the film. And this is another film that that probably foolishly I would really recommend broadly, The Visitor.
Yeah.
So The Visitor was my favorite film of the year.
Yeah, I mean, I can definitely see how this would appeal to a broad audience. It's definitely accessible enough that I think a lot of people who didn't see it or didn't know about it, if they checked it out now, I think they would probably appreciate it. I wouldn't say that I disliked it, but I didn't really, you know, I don't think I connected with it the way that you did. I did feel it was, I wouldn't call it manipulative, and I wouldn't call it too liberal. Actually, I was expecting, based on some reviews that I read, for it to be more heavy-handed, and it isn't. I mean, in that it clearly has a message that it's conveying, and at times it comes on a little strong, but I don't think that's necessarily a problem. I just felt the theme of the sort of, you know, uptight white guy who's lost his zest for life after his wife has died and, you know, comes to appreciate things thanks to these soulful immigrants was just a little cheap.
Well, that's that is cheap.
Yeah.
And what I think makes it a significant experience is the direction by Tom McCarthy, who's an actor himself, and did The Station Agent, which I think you liked.
Yeah, I did like The Station Agent,
And Richard Jenkins' performance, and the younger alien couple, or illegal couple.
Right.
Of course, if you say they're illegals, then 75% of the audience is not going to like it. But
when
I think this is a film that very much transcends its plot. When you give me the plot, yes, you're absolutely right that it sounds cut and paste, connect the dots. But I think it is taken way far beyond its plot machinations into a profound human experience, which I had.
Well, no, that's great. I didn't feel like it didn't go far enough beyond for me, but I appreciated some stuff about it. And so in a completely opposite, I think we could not have more different thematic movies. Your movie, very, very human, very, you know, positive about the way people can connect. And my number one movie is basically a movie about how awful everyone and everything is, which is Funny Games, Michael Haneke's remake of, like, shot-for-shot remake of his 1997 German film, which this stars Naomi Watts and Tim Roth as a sort of bourgeois upper-middle-class couple who go away to their vacation home and end up terrorized by this pair of disturbingly polite teenagers who increasingly do awful, awful things to them. And this is a movie, and I would hazard a guess that there's at least an 80% chance that you would hate this movie. I know you haven't seen it. And probably 70 or 80% of critics did hate this movie. And I can understand why, because it's a movie that in a way is very arrogant and very condescending. And the director, I think, has hurt himself by saying that this movie is about the despicable nature of the depiction of violence in films. And that if you like this movie and violence that you see in this movie, then, you know, it should be teaching you something to not, you know, to feel disturbed by your enjoyment of violence. And I think when you offer that sort of condescending analysis of your audience, you know, you set people against you right from the start. But I think if you can remove yourself from what the director has said in interviews or whatever and look at this movie simply divorced from that, which I think is what you have to do with most movies. You have to look at them on their own terms And it is an incredibly effective thriller. I don't think I've seen a more viscerally disturbing movie in years. When at the screening of this movie, after we came out, the publicity rep from the studio said she felt like she needed to vomit. And yet there is no violence depicted on screen. It's almost all done by implication or done off screen. And yet it can disturb you so, so much. And it's incredibly edge of your seat kind of thrilling, which at the same time, it has enough of that meta element and the things that he talks about in interviews that it will make you think about, why do you react this way? Or
would you compare it to any other film or any perhaps more popular film in the past years?
I mean, it's interesting because it's like, there's actually another horror movie that came out this year called The Strangers that I thought was quite good. The Strangers is basically a straight-faced take on this concept, where that is simply a suspense movie about people in an isolated house getting terrorized by killers. And this movie is about that exact same thing, except it's also about, why do we like movies about killers?
Josh Bell hates everything except me.